Welcome to Social Justice Matters, a podcast from Social Justice Ireland. I'm Eamon Murphy, Economic and Social Analyst. This weekend just passed, there was an article in the Sunday Business Post by journalist Daniel Murray examining basic income. Our CEO, Dr. Sean Healy, was interviewed as part of the piece, so we thought it would be a useful opportunity to look back to our social policy conference in 2016 when we looked at the area of basic income in detail. Now, what follows is an audio recording of the opening presentation on that day by Social Justice Ireland founders Bridget Reynolds and Dr. Sean Healy. The full paper, on which their opening address was based, is available at www.socialjustice.ie. Just type in Basic Income Conference 2016 on our website, and you'll find both the paper, which you can download and read for free, and a video of the presentation, which examines the changing dynamics around social policy, which make a move towards a basic income imperative if we are to achieve a fair and just society. Do enjoy.
Good morning. Today we're looking at an overview of social policy, and there's three things we want to look at. No, I just have this overview up there. The social policy landscape. Then we are going to look at the key developments that have taken place over the last few years. We want to look at the impact of the crisis of 2008 on social policy. Then we go on to look at rights, particularly the right to work, income and participation. We go on then to look at basic income and propose that it is a better pathway forward. And finally, we look at some objections, populist objections to basic income. So then to begin with our paper, We talk about different approaches to social policy. Social policy has changed fundamentally in both Europe and in North America in recent decades. Governments have taken different approaches to addressing issues such as social welfare, labour market policies, and the provision of services in areas such as education and health. Trends in social welfare are no longer simply a question of whether the resources allocated are rising or falling. Ensuring that everyone has the basics required to live life with dignity is a much more challenging task today than it was even 20 years ago. We have seen the emergence of issues such as activation, social investment, social inclusion, and the growing focus on the connection between rights and responsibilities. In summary, there have been two opposing viewpoints concerning what has been happening. On the one hand, many argue that there is a neoliberal logic underpinning developments in recent decades, and that this approach implies the dismantling of the traditional welfare state. On the other hand, many believe that what we are seeing is the development of reforms that help to modernise welfare and ensure that it adjusts to the realities of the 21st century. So we go on then to look at three key developments. And the first one concerns citizenship. Marshall understood the welfare state to have emerged from a broadening understanding of citizenship and the rights that went with being a citizen. He noted the evolution of rights. In the 18th century, civil rights had emerged. These included freedom of speech, freedom of religion, and the right to own property. These were followed in the 19th century by the emergence of political rights for citizens. These included the right to vote, to hold public, and to hold public office. Marshall saw the 20th century as having produced social rights. These included the right to economic and social security through education, housing, healthcare, pensions, and other services. This third stage in the development of rights led to the acceptance of the view that everyone was entitled to sufficient income to live a full, active life, irrespective of their background. While there is some debate about Marshall's analysis, his core point that rights and responsibilities are closely linked with the idea of citizenship has been very popular in recent years, as the idea of active citizenship has been promoted. His understanding of an evolving and expanding set of rights linked to citizenship continues to exercise major influence. Some would argue that the evolution of rights continues as they point to the emergence of rights and responsibilities towards the environment as a further development in that process. Two factors that are essential to the development of this kind of citizenship envisaged by Marshall are, firstly, there needs to be a recognition of the interdependence of the political, the social, and the civil dimension of policy. And secondly, there is a need for a social dialogue that can ensure the experiences and the concerns of vulnerable and or excluded groups are recognised in the development of the common good. The second key development in recent decades concerns benefits, entitlements, and the welfare state. Different governments are using different approaches. Some have emphasized social investment, others have highlighted the enabling state, others again are focusing on the active welfare state. Some of these developments are reducing benefits, while others are not. What is clear is that these adjustments are bringing qualitative changes to the welfare state. The third development, which flows from the two already mentioned, highlights is that we are, to the two already highlighted, is that we are witnessing a change in paradigm underlying the welfare state. While there is a recognition that ongoing funding of the welfare state is challenging, the principal focus has not been on achieving purely quantitative targets. Rather, a qualitative focus has sought to discover new ways of ensuring that welfare could be delivered in a more efficient way that suited the changing economic and political realities. Those who are arguing for an activating social investment agenda are in fact seeking a profound paradigm shift. They see welfare as not only about protecting people, but also about enhancing their capacity to deal with their changing environments. A new reality seems to have emerged since 2008, one in which social policy has been downgraded and pushed to the sidelines when major decisions are being made. The economic and fiscal crisis of 2008 led to the sharpest contraction of European economies since the Great Depression. In 2009, for example, the economic output of the countries of the European Union shrank by 4.5%, and more than 6 million people have lost their jobs. Commenting on this situation, the distinguished economist and philosopher Amartya Sen pointed out, what began as a clear failure of the market economy, particularly associated with financial institutions, was soon interpreted as a problem of the overstretched role of the state, leading to the prioritization of austerity measures. As the crisis spread, a series of measures were adopted, including consolidation and adjustment, which led to austerity policies. Fiscal supervision, which led to new fiscal governance mechanisms, for example, the fiscal compact. These are political responses to an economic crisis and are inappropriate. This has led to a situation where a perception of a democratic deficit at the heart of the EU has been reinforced, and citizens in many countries experience a sense of powerlessness. So what has been the impact of the crisis? A number of studies of the period from 2008 to 2013 across a number of EU states show greatly reduced incomes, increased poverty and social exclusion, increased unemployment, increased numbers of people living in low work intensity households. The Europe 2020 strategy was supposed to focus on achieving high levels of employment, productivity and social cohesion. Now research shows that social cohesion is declining, or at least under new pressures. This is due not only to the economic and employment crisis, but also due to the longer term trends such as growing inequality, migration, immigration, and the increased cultural diversity and increasing social disparities in relation to issues of poverty, labour market access, health and equitable education. Studies also show that social justice has been under pressure, has had a negative effect on social justice in most countries. The impact of the crisis on social policy shows that the EU 2020 strategy was given nowhere near the priority or the resources it required if it were to be a substantial counterweight to the austerity policies being implemented. Over the past 50 years then, a future of full employment and zero poverty has been held out as a viable outcome of the policies being followed. It is time for the EU to recognise that these policies are not fit for the purpose of delivering such a future. The present model is broken, and it is time to face that reality. Alternatives need to be analysed and tested. We believe that basic income is one such alternative. So what should guide society's understanding and development of the future? In this paper, we now go on to argue that shaping a viable, sustainable future must start with the understanding of the common good. And Sean will take up now.
Thank you. Now, in the paper, we have a
certain amount of material drawing on sources from John Rawls to the National Economic and Social Council, looking at the whole issue of what the common good needs and so on. I don't know that I want to spend much time on it here in this, because we are up against it having started a little bit late. We're trying to catch up in time. But it's there, and we can tease it out in the discussion if people want to focus on that particular issue. But it is central, because the new paradigm does need some kind of basis, and we would argue that the common good is a very, very good way of actually would provide a very good foundation for a new paradigm. Basically being the sum of the conditions, for example, of social life by which individuals, families and groups can achieve their own fulfillment in a relatively thorough and ready way. One of the things that's core to this is the need to recognise that human rights and the common good are interdependent, in the sense that we won't have the human rights that Bridget has been talking about and their development without some focus and without some recognition that these are important to be delivered as part of the common good. Likewise, I don't think we will deliver the common good without a recognition of the rights that are there. So the other piece that's important in all of that is sustainability, because at the end of the day, if whatever we're trying to develop in a new paradigm is not sustainable, then there's no point in having it. For example, there's a lot of talk today about environmental sustainability, but there's a lot of challenges in economic sustainability, and even more in, I think, more challenging and less and more ignored, if you like, social sustainability. Because what we're developing a lot of the time, we fail to ask the question, will people want to live in this kind of society? And if they don't, then we're not going to go too far. That particular approach, whatever it might be, would not actually go very far. So I think we're in this kind of situation. Okay. So now, we in Social Justice Ireland have been arguing for quite a while that seven basic rights need to be secured for everybody if they're to have what is required to live life with dignity. By the way, these are not the only rights that we think are important or essential, but we do think they're essential in this context, and we highlight them. Everybody needs the right to meaningful work, to have access to meaningful work, to have access to enough income to live life with dignity, to have access to real participation, that's just the notion of participation, to have access to relevant education, essential healthcare, appropriate accommodation, and cultural respect. And they're not the only rights, as I say, but they are essential if we can live our lives with dignity. Now, these rights are not currently available to large numbers of people in the European Union in the way, not that they don't have theoretically the right to access these, but in actual fact, having them and exercising them is the challenge. And there are huge numbers of people in poverty, unemployed. We have seen, for example, not that in our own time, quite an amount of emergence of people being quite annoyed about the fact that they are not consulted, they have no real participation in shaping the decisions that affect them. New approaches are needed in that context. Most people in Ireland would feel that they got very little, if any, say, for example, in the decisions that led to the bailout and all the various austerity approaches that have been used since then. But that's also true, I think, a lot of people would have been reacting to the lack of voice that they have in places, in votes, recent votes like Brexit and the election in the United States as well. Now, for the rest, I want to go on to focus on the first three of these here, not because the others aren't important, but I think these are kind of interrelated and they are central. The first of these is the right to work. There's the meaning of work is an issue that we need to look at. When you ask people what they work at, they hear the question as being, what job do you have? And then what we've done in effect as a society and as a world really is to limit the meaning of work down to paid employment, which it obviously is not. There's lots of other work that is recognized as work really, except that it's not treated as work because it's not paid employment. Sort of work and development of oneself, of one's family, of one's community, of the wider society, all sorts of things that contribute in one way or another in that way need to be recognized, even if they are not paid employment. There's the role of work in personal development needs to be recognised quite strongly. Likewise, the social dimension of work, because we relate to other people. We are social beings and we relate to other people through work. Work is essential as well, and participation in meaningful work is essential if people are to actually participate in developing the society and the world in which they live and in providing the goods and services. But the critical thing that's important in this context, in a world which is seeing a rise, high levels of unemployment, in a world that has for 2.5 centuries promised full employment and never delivered it, I think we need to be facing the fact that there are serious issues in which that we're now coming to a point we need to recognise that we will not have full employment in our generation or the next generation or any future generation that we can envisage. And consequently, we need to recognise that in that context, that everybody has a right to work. So what that actually, there's a quite serious challenge there that needs to be addressed. We also need to look at the right to income. Large numbers of people are living in poverty, even in the European Union, and the richest areas of the world, in our own country. We have scandalous situations, and I think people are aware of the numbers. I'm not going to go through them here. They're in the paper. But what we would say is adequate income is a birthright. But that there is, like, Ireland is not a poor country. Ireland has more than enough resource to ensure that everybody has enough income to live life with dignity. But it's a distribution issue, a political issue in many ways, and we haven't actually addressed it, and we don't seem to be heading towards addressing it either, which is a quite serious issue. Since the Industrial Revolution, the paradigm is based on income being distributed through payment for jobs done. But then if people don't have access to jobs for great parts of their lives, or if the new world of jobs, which are precarious and short-term and low pay and so on, these kinds of challenges that are there, people forget in a way, they think that income is what you get your income by doing a job and you get paid for the value of the job that you do, and that's, you know, it's the effort that you put in gets you the money, but that's actually not true. It's very, the level of income that you actually get is very tied to the technology you have access to or to the power of your negotiating group. So, okay, it has certain amounts of it's in some parts connected to the work you actually do, but there are huge other issues there. So what we're basically saying, jobs were not delivered in the last couple of centuries for everybody. They won't be delivered in the future. So a new paradigm is required to deal with, to reclaim people's birthright. And that brings us to the third, because participation and work are essential as well. People have a right to be involved. They have a right to shape the world in which they live. They have a right to participate in shaping the decisions that impact on them. But that's not the experience that great many people have. So participation and is critical and is very, very important. And people participate through work, but there's also lots of other things, as I pointed out. There's one little piece there that I would draw your attention to on pages 19 and 20. I just referenced them up there. 7 principles to guide a just process of decision making. Because sometimes in this country, we don't seem to think that people have a right to participate in shaping decisions because we can't think of ways in which we can resolve disagreement. If you look at the 7, all people affected by decisions are to have an equal right to take part in and to determine the outcome of and the processes that establish the decisions that with which they are to comply. And there are a series of other principles in there. I think they're very good. People have a right to disagree with and to oppose any proposal being made for decision. Sometimes, for example, in some of the response to Brexit, you wonder, do we have a choice in making, in sort of what should be done? We're dictated to about this, that, and the other is what has to be done. And when you raise an issue saying, for example, could we go back and check why Brexit happened in the first place? What are the causes? That's seen as, from the very top, seen as sort of a heretical question that's not allowed. I've had that experience myself with the same leader or good leader. So in that sense, I'm pointing to something that's real, and I that would concern me hugely. We're running around dealing with the consequences of a quite serious event. All of those consequences have to be dealt with. But unless we're dealing with the causes, we'll be back making similar decisions again and having similar discussions in due course. So moving on to basic income specifically, there's a definition of basic income. You'll get several versions of this in the various papers of the book today and in the introduction and so on. The way we do it is we take this off the Basic Income Ireland website. So I think we both agree that this is what it should be. A universal basic income is a payment from the state to every resident on an individual basis without any means test or work requirement. It would be sufficient to live a frugal but decent lifestyle without supplementary income from paid employment. For further information, then I refer you in the book to Basic Income Ireland's website and our own website and Basic and BN's website as well. I think the objectives of basic income are to address growing fragility in the labour market, the precariat, not enough jobs and so on. Secondly, the failure to eliminate poverty, even in very rich nations, needs to be addressed. The need to address exclusion of vulnerable people from having a voice. And basic income, we would argue, will actually deal with all of these. There's a series of populist arguments as long as your arm, actually, and some of them came out in Morning Ireland this morning. She was dealing with one or two of them, but you get these automatically, these kind of populist arguments against it. We list about 10 there, and we deal with them very quickly. Basic income would encourage idleness. This simply isn't true. In effect, when it's the other way around. People are encouraged to be idle because they must be available for jobs that don't exist. And if they do something useful, they'll probably be cost and kind of the claim will be made that they're not available for the non-existent job, so therefore they may well lose their entitlements or whatever. The bottom line is that basic income actually encourages people's engagement, not the idleness. It promotes the end of work. No, it does not. Anybody who supports basic income is very strongly in favour of work and having meaningful work and decent work. And not alone that, but the studies that have been done show that people, once they're freed up from having these kind of conditions that are in welfare, actually are, with a floor under them, are much more likely to become involved. Feasibility, they say that it's not affordable. I think Malcolm Torrey, he's presenting, I think, the next paper actually here. He has just produced a book on the feasibility of basic income under every heading you could possibly think about. He'll tell you about all of it, or some of it anyway, in his paper. But the bottom line on this is, of course, it's affordable, and it's affordable in Ireland as well, as we will show later in the day in another paper being presented by Eamon Murphy and Sean Ward. It would mean a large increase in tax. In fact, that's not true. It would involve a reasonable approach to and a very much fairer approach to taxation, because it would eliminate some of the tax breaks that benefit better off people and that other people don't have access to. You'll see the tax proposal that's in the paper that I mentioned already is there as well. There's a migration issue. The issue here is misrepresented endlessly. I was quite annoyed myself to see somebody like Henning Meyer, who's the editor of Social Europe Journal, peddling this nonsense. Because in actual fact, when you introduce a basic income, you would obviously have conditions on people accessing it when they come into the country. It's not a question that we're going to be flooded by people from Eastern Europe, all of whom come in for basic income, because they wouldn't have a right to a basic income. They don't have a right to welfare when they come in the first place either. So it would have to be built up over time. And I think that's the way this would work, and there are lots of ways of doing that. But I think it's important when you're objecting to something that that there would be some basis to some of the claims that are made. Another one of the... My screen here is different to what you're seeing up there. These are five more that would encourage idleness. Something wrong here now. Oh, sorry, it's the next one. Okay, it leads to the abolition of the welfare state. This is nonsense. Of course it won't. a basic income without the services and so on that are required, and all the rest of the welfare state would be problematic in the first place. So basic income would come would not lead to the abolition of the welfare state. What it would do is it would provide the income component, put that into place, but you still have to have decent education and health and all the rest of the welfare state, and I think that's important. Basic income doesn't solve the inequality issue. You know, there's most of our social policy wouldn't actually qualify very well or be funded if that was going to be the condition on which it was actually funded. I mean, does anybody suggest that our current system promotes the equality all that well? That doesn't mean that equality shouldn't be promoted. Of course it should. We would argue that basic income may not solve the inequality, but it will actually promote equality a little bit, at least by putting a floor under everybody that is actually there and has a right and not taken away any time during their lives. Everyone should earn their living. I find this kind of interesting in the context of the way it understands earning. Apparently, people who are well off or born into wealthy families don't have to work at all for their lives, and that's perfectly okay. They can live off the family's money and enjoy the life any way they like, and that's perfectly okay. But the rest of us have to earn our living for some reason or other. I would duly respectfully suggest that that's daft, and coming to that kind of conclusion, and that what we really need is people need to contribute to shaping their own future, shaping the future of the society they're in, making contribution and having the capacity to do that, and that in that process they contribute. Basic income reduces the value of work to mere income. With due respect, I think it's the other way around, that tying work to payment for a job ties work to mere income. And it's not the other way around. In actual fact, by putting a floor under everybody, we liberate people. So it's not, and then so turning it into some work, into some mere income. And basic income is an inefficient use of public resources. I smile, and I could give you lots of examples of what might happen if we actually applied that principle to everywhere, and lots of public policy, you know, getting value for money and all that sort of stuff. An efficient use of public resources. What I would say is I would argue very strongly that basic income is one of the most efficient uses of public resources, and we have real potential in that situation. Final slide. Is it a real utopia or a practical solution? I think the thing that we would point to first is that the current approach is failing to deliver, and a universal basic income has the capacity to be the cornerstone of a new paradigm. And our conclusion would be that it is both a radical step towards a desirable future and a practical solution to several major challenges facing society today. That's why we would strongly support the development of a basic income system and its implementation in Ireland, in the European Union, and across the world.
We hope you've enjoyed our podcast. Why not check out our website, www.socialjustice.ie, for more information on basic income. As I mentioned at the beginning, if you type in Basic Income Conference 2016 on our website, you'll find access to all the papers from the day, which you can download and read for free, and a video of each presentation. These include papers examining basic income trials in Holland and Finland, papers from leading economists Malcolm Torrey and Anthony Painter, material from Ronan Lyons of Trinity College on how a universal housing subsidy might form part of a basic income, and a paper from myself, Eamon Murphy, on how much a basic income in Ireland might cost. Until next time, thank you for listening.